Hi, my name is Scott Budimir. I'm with IDW Publishing, and to my left is Walter Simonson and Louise Simonson. They run a bed and breakfast in New Hampshire. Wait, that's why.
And we'd love to have you stop by.
There's a nice picture of
Mr. very
Simonson.
Nice.
God.
Great.
I went ahead and I grabbed a few things off the internet, so it's got to be true. First off, I'm going to keep this pretty brief on my part. I'll let Walter and Weezy do most of the talking because that's what you hear. That's what you want to hear, and you're right. So I think it's fair to say that Walter and Louise Simonson are the first couple in comics. You know, they are
the third. Maybe the fourth, Scott. Fourth couple of comics.
I'm not trying to say they're old, okay? But honestly, you know, Walter and Louise, besides being just two of the most talented people married to each other, they are also two of the nicest people that I know. You know, absolutely. You know, a lot of people say, you know, so-and-so is the nicest person in comics. They're all wrong, unless they're talking about Walter and Louise.
Here's your $5, Scott. Thanks. That was great.
Good job. All right. So Walter is known for.
I recognize that cover.
A lot of stuff, but one of the things he's known for is his run on Thor. Louise is known. Walter also collaborated with his good friend Archie Goodwin on the Jack which, by the way, was the first graphic novel that actually made it to the New York Times bestseller list. And, you know, a lot of comics make the New York Times bestseller list nowadays. And I'm very happy when any of my books that I edit are on that list. But I'll tell you a secret. That's the graphic novel list. That's not the bestseller list, that's the book list. This made it to the real deal, like hundreds of thousands of copies sold list. He's also working on
I'm sure.
This is Manhunter, of course, that you guys all know. Louise also worked on Superman, as well as a number of other movies. I had to throw in Dr. Fate from First Edition Special, because I love it. I forgot Metal Man.
That's all right.
And Orion. I can't view what's coming up next, but I think this one is the last one, and some of you might not quite get it, but Louise can fill you in on it.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
You know what
I'm going to say, I will, yeah.
Everyone knows that.
I know. Yeah.
This is the cover of the very first Swamp Thing books, House of Secrets 92, by Bernie Wrightson. And you can see Swamp Thing in the back, and the model for this piece is sitting over here.
Back in the day.
Sorry, I didn't embarrass you.
It's nice to have your entire career boiled down to being Bernie Wrightson's model before you're actually getting comics.
Actually, you know what? Maybe that's not so bad.
Not so bad. And hey, the first Swamp Thing.
First Swamp Thing. So I think what I'll do is I'll ask them a couple of questions and then let them go off from there, and then after that we'll do some Q&A, because I'm sure your questions will be much more interesting than mine. First, why don't we ask both? Why don't we ask both Walter and Weezy if they could tell us how they broke into comics?
Sure, you guys have heard this story like 13,000 times already. Well, I'm going to get out here very often, so. In the mid-60s, I was in college. I picked up Journey into Mystery 120, which turned out to be the first of a four-part story with Thor and the Absorbing Man. I got sucked into Marvel Comics. Within 3 months, I was reading every Marvel comic that was coming out. At a time, they put out like 11 titles, and it would cost 20 cents a piece or whatever they were. So it didn't break the bank, and I could read all of them. And so for several years, I just read every Marvel comic was. I read comics as a kid, but I kind of quit. I branched out, began reading more stuff, and eventually thought maybe I'd like to try and break in. I'd always drawn pictures. I'd never thought about art as a career. My dad was a scientist. The family friends were all scientists. Nobody knew anything about freelancing as a way of making a living. Didn't quite seem like a real job. Still doesn't quite seem like a real job. But basically, I went to art school. I did a portfolio while I was there. I did a comic book as a senior degree project. My senior thesis was a 50-page comic, science fiction, that I wrote and drew, penciled and inked, lettered, and kept this in black and white. And I took that to New York City in the August of 72 to try and show people in comics and get work. At the time, there were only two companies, Marvel and DC, putting out the kind of comics I wanted to do. At that time, no FedEx, no internet, no overnight deliveries of any sort. Pretty much what it meant was if you wanted to do comics of that sort, you moved to New York City because you had to be able to deliver your work in a timely fashion. So most of the guys I came in with, the Bernie Wrightsons and the Howard Shakers, Alan Weiss's, Alan Milgram's, all those guys, we all moved to New York City within about a 3 or 4 year period of each other, trying to get into the business. I went up to D.C. At the time I was there in 72, D.C. was putting out comics I thought were the niftiest comics any company was. I'd read Marvels, I still read them, but I liked what D.C. was doing at that point. So I went to D.C. I had the complete good fortune, I won't give you the whole story, but the complete good luck to be shown into Carmen Infantino's office just on a fluke, really. And I had my portfolio. Carmine got a look at it. It turned out, if you ever look at Carmine's work, if you know it, he is really quite a good designer. His sense of composition and the way he treats shape and the way he treats negative shape is very powerful. And my work is very designy. It's very shape-oriented. He recognized that in the work. He asked me if I knew the work of Bernie Krigstein. Do you guys know who Bernie Krigstein is? So many of you would understand that. An EC artist. And Krigstein's work, it was very linear. It was very design-oriented. At that time, I had not seen it. But we ended up having about a 10-minute chat, about which I remember nothing because I was so blown away by being in his office, basically. But he really liked my work. And so at that time, comics still had backup features. Not so many now, but they had little House of Mystery and Star Spangled War stories and comics that had lead features and then 5 or 6 page backups. And what it meant was when you were new in comics at that time, instead of doing the indie market or whatever you would do now, they would give you a 4 or 5 page backup and you would draw that, an inventory story, and then you'd give you another one. And you could make enough money to make a living while you were learning your craft. So what happened was Carmine liked my work enough, even though I'd been turned down by a couple of editors earlier in the day, he called 3 of his editors into his office and made them all give me a backup story. So I walked out of Carmine's office with 3 backup stories. And fortunately, I didn't screw them up that badly. So when I was done the stories, one of the editors, Archie Goodwin, who had became a good friend afterwards, offered me a little more work and a little more work. And gradually, I began to learn how to really draw. I began to learn how to tell stories. And that kind of blossomed eventually into a career that worked out pretty well. I made enough money to stay alive. I don't quite understand how. I look back now. I guess I had a lot of hamburger helper and stuff like that at the time. I shudder to think. But essentially, that was how I broke in. I was able to see Carmine. He liked my stuff. And from his urging and his nudging to his other editors, I was able to get enough work that eventually I was able to get regular gigs. Within 6 months of my being in New York, Archie Goodwin offered me a strip called Manhunter that he was going to start doing in the back of Detective Comics. And Manhunter, this is before there was a fandom the way we have now, before there really were conventions much, in the way of comic conventions. So what happened with that was the Manhunter strip did well professionally, by which I mean a lot of professionals saw it, a lot of professionals liked it, and in the end, when that strip was done about a year later, I didn't have to go looking for work. Most professionals at Marvel and DC, they knew who I was and they were willing to hire me. So it worked out very well. Okay. The end.
And Louise, if you could tell us.
Okay. I was in New York. I was working in advertising promotion for a magazine company. And one of my friends worked at Warren Publishing, and she said, well, there's an opening there in the production department. You could do the job, and it will pay better than your job. Why don't you come apply? And I had read the Warren comics and really liked them, so I said, sure. So I went and applied, and I got the job. It turns out I was not terribly great at production, but I was really good at the editorial stuff. It was a very small company, and they were willing to let anyone do anything they were willing to do. So when they said, can you write ad copy? And I'd say, sure. Oh, we need somebody to do that. I can do letters columns. And eventually they just moved me to the gratitude of all, I suppose, out of production into editorial. They created an assistant editor position for me. And from that I worked, I had for a couple of years, I guess. I never know how long I do anything. And eventually became the senior editor at Warren, and then eventually went over to work at Marvel, and then eventually got bored with editing and started writing. So that's the short version.
I'm gonna stick one more story in here, which I hope will not bore you guys, but I just think it's really cool. The thing about getting a job in a small company is that part of what happens is, in Wheezy's case, she was willing to try anything, to do stuff, and she's eager, and she was interested, and she would volunteer to do stuff, and you never know where that's going to take you. And the reason I say this is because, at the time, the story was that Warren made his money. If you look at an old Warren magazine, Eerie or Creepy or Vampirella, there's a catalog in the back for junk. It's like action figures and monster masks and monster hands and fake blood and whatever he could sell. It was called the Captain Company, and Warren was very picky about that. There was a grid layout with it, and the idea was, basically, kids bought the magazine to read the comics, but what they were really doing was buying his catalog, and he would then sell them stuff from the catalog, and that was how he made his money. So the comics were there to facilitate getting people to look at the catalog. The catalog in the back was in a grid pattern, had a photograph in each square, each rectangle, had a photograph of the product, and copy below it telling them how fantastic this fake blood was, or how realistic these monster hands were, or what fabulous Dracula teeth. You could be just like Christopher Lee if you wore these teeth. And the copy, if you look at the copy, it had to be in a little block. And back in the day before computers, printers had to set that type, and they have a certain flexibility. And what would happen is you would write the sentence for the copy. I'll do it from your perspective. Da-da-da-da, 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 da. And you'd have a whole sentence. But you'd have a little extra white space in that box where the copy didn't fill. And Warren felt he was being robbed if he didn't have every bit of white space in that box, in all those boxes, filled exactly. Now, printers back then, you could do a certain amount of maneuvering of the type. You could let space them out wider, your letter space them, you could close them up. So there was a certain amount of room to maneuver. And what that meant was that in one of these little boxes of copy, there was a certain amount of number of characters, spaces, and letters you could put in one of those shapes. And what that meant was you had to have somebody who could write the description for Dracula's teeth and how fantastic they were in exactly 342 to 370 characters. And then the printer could fudge that to make it come out right. It was called writing to character count. And it turned out that Wheezy was fantastic at writing the character count and fairly mediocre at production, because production was really boring, so she would sort of go to sleep doing stuff and it wouldn't come out right. But she was challenged by the writing and she was very good. So that was one of the reasons that really, because she could write and do this in this weird structure, she was moved over to editorial, which was really the beginning of a pretty cool career in comic books. So you never know what you're going to find that's going to be valuable, how it's going to turn out. You try everything. That may be an always volunteer idea. I'm not sure about that, but basically it worked out just fine. And I think it's a funny story. It's just a weird, it depended on Warren being, you know, very specific about what he wanted in the books, and Weezy was able to supply it.
Okay. Actually, you know, Weezy, I would like to, I would like to ask you if you could talk a little bit more about Warren. How many years were you there?
I don't know, Walter, how long was I there?
1974 to 1980.
Okay, so I was there 6 years.
And you worked with I mean, at that point, there were some, you know, Warren was an interesting company. The first couple of years, they had great artists.
Oh, yeah.
And then they must have just dropped their rates or something, because all of a sudden, all the great artists fled.
Yeah, the rumor, I don't know to this day if it's true, the rumor is that Warren lost all his money in Las Vegas. I don't know that that's true. That's a rumor.
It's a cool story. We'd like it to be true.
That was spread around the office, but it probably wasn't true anyway. And so that he had no money to... The thing was that was the explanation for why he had no money to spend on good artists, right. And then he had bad artists for a lot of years.
And but then when you were there, it sort of turned around.
Well, it had turned around a bit before then. Selecciones de los Stratos, it's a Spanish... agency, art agency, had made contact with Warren.
Louis Bermejo was there.
Jose Dutain was the agent.
A lot of great guys.
And there was a lot of working with the Spaniards, and the Spaniards really brought real quality work to Warren. A lot of that work had been done already in Europe.
Okay, so those were reprints.
Some of them were, but then eventually... us guys at Warren started supplying them with scripts, which then they could then reprint in Europe. So it was kind of an interaction we would get stories in from them with no words at all. And, you know, we just hand the stories out to artists, to writers that we thought could do a good job of putting words into them. And, you know, they really mostly, it was a pretty good interaction. And we turned out some really good stories. Yeah. And then it was... Bill DeBay, I think, was the editor-in-chief at that time.
You were also one of the guys that you worked with, I believe, was Alex Toth for a while.
Oh, yes, Alex. Alex was great. I mean, he's a brilliant, brilliant artist. But he was so cranky and difficult. It was really hard to get any work out of him. He was really his own worst critic. He would get a story and he would love it. And then he would start drawing it, and it wouldn't be the way he wanted it to, and it wouldn't come out. And
in reality, it would look fantastic. It would look fantastic.
Sure.
You know, one of the things I loved is that, you know, are you guys familiar with Alex Toth's work at all?
Okay.
You know, he does a lot of solid blacks, a lot of black design. All of that stuff is drawn underneath. Like, you know, he would draw whole characters in costumes, and then just take a black marker or black ink and just... black stuff in, because he liked the design of the black and it looked great.
He wanted the structure.
Yes, it was the structure. In the end, the structure was there. I don't know, when I was a kid, the first time I saw that, I was just blown away. It was like, whoa, look at this. You know, it's all this stuff, and he just covered it up because it didn't need it.
It's funny, Toth was notoriously cranky, grumpy.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't so grumpy with you.
No, he loved me, but that didn't mean I could get work out of him.
No.
It just meant that he loved me. It was fun. It was fun to talk to him, and I think it made him happy to talk to me. But it didn't make it hardly any easier to get work. Although I did get some Conan pinups of all things.
Oh, those are beautiful.
Aren't those gorgeous?
Yeah.
When I moved over to Marvel. I called him up and I said, you know, can you do me some Conan pinups? And he gave me five of them. And I think there were five. We owned one of
really
them.
Beautiful.
And they were fabulous. I don't know. I don't know what it was about that assignment that was more enticing to him than some of the other stuff. But, you know, you take what you can get and you're very grateful for it when you work with Alex. Another artist that I really loved working with was John Severin. He was wonderful. I married Walter because he sort of reminded me of John Severin. Because when I used to talk to John on the phone, it was like, I don't know, he was great.
I should be so lucky.
And, you know, he's 89 now, and did you see the miniseries he's
still working. And the work is still beautiful, I know.
Here's, I have to tell a little, that you may have to jump in and correct me if I'm wrong. He did a story for Wheezy. I don't know who the writer was. It was a World War I story and about flyers, I think. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that John is well known for in the industry and well known elsewhere is he is extremely accurate in his depictions of uniforms, all that military hardware. He is a master of that stuff, and he is very careful with it, and you could take that stuff to the bank. So he did a story for Wheezy, and he mailed it in, and it came in, and not long thereafter, Wheezy got a frantic phone call from John.
Yeah. Okay, he calls me up at home, and in this panic.
That's right, at home.
At home. And he says, you can't print the story, you've got to send it back to me, I've got to make corrections. I said, well, what, why? And he said, I got the costumes wrong. It was the
uniforms.
World War uniforms wrong. The uniforms that he drew were 1917.
They were like 1917.
And the story took place in 1918, and they had changed the costumes.
That meant the buttons were different.
The buttons were different.
The belt buckles weren't quite the same.
I said, John, it doesn't really matter in the story what year it is. What if we just changed the year?
We just changed the lettering.
And he said, oh, okay. Well, that was that. Problem solved.
That's a great story.
That's really funny. But John was just a master of that stuff, and he was very proud of the work he was doing, and he did not want to get screwed up. And he didn't want to screw it up.
You've got to really... I think that was one of the things I loved about him. That's I think, my favorite John Severance story. And it kind of just really speaks to the kind of guy he is. He was willing to redo an entire story because he had gotten a few buttons wrong. I mean, you know...
He didn't call up and say, let's change the lettering.
No, I didn't.
Send the job back. I'll change all the uniforms. Rather than change the writer's idea. It's great.
Yeah, no, wonderful. So, Walter, after Manhunter, you did a number of different things. You worked on The Metal Men. You worked on, which is a favorite of mine, well, especially that first issue that was written by Steve Gerber, and then he only did the first issue, and then later on the other issues were written by Jerry Conway.
I did. There were two by Jerry Conway and two by Marty Pascoe. It was a bi-monthly book. I was given the first issue that Gerber had written. Steve had written it. It was in a drawer somewhere. By the time, I'm not quite sure why it was given to me. I think Carmine still liked my work and wanted to maybe revive The Metal Men, so he brought this script out of a drawer. I'm not too sure how much earlier Steve had written it, but it wasn't something Steve wrote for me. It was in the drawer somewhere. So I got that script to draw. I drew it, and Carmine decided that they would relaunch the Metal Men book. And by this time, Steve had gone back to work at Marvel. Back in those days especially, a lot of younger talent, me included, you would kind of jump back and forth from company to company. One of the deals with that is that frequently, if you're at one place for a while, you're kind of taken for granted. So in order to, and page rates were not that high. This is pre-royalties. So your page rates, you were getting paid piecework, really. You got paid a page rate. I think my page rate when I first got to New York was like $40 a page for pencils and inks. But you could make a living on that. Not a great living, but you could make a living out of it. In this case, Steve had already gone back to Marvel because you would jump companies, you'd get your page rate up, you'd be working at DC for a while. And they would say, well, you're still working at DC. And Marvel would say, well, come work for us. We'll pay you $5 more a page. Oh, cool. And you'd go over to DC and you'd work there. I mean, Marvel. And then DC would go, oh, well, he used to work here and now he's not. Let's pay him another $5 a page. So you would kind of jump back and forth to kind of get your rate up as if you possibly could. And Steve had already gone. Now, whether that was why Steve left, I don't know. He was already gone. But he'd gone back to Marvel as, you know, we all moved around. So at the time, when they wanted to keep doing more Metal Men, they got Jerry Conway to begin writing it. Jerry wrote two issues, and then he went back to Marvel. And so then they got Marty Pascoe to write two issues. It was a bi-monthly book. I was penciling and inking it, and I was not that fast. I could kind of get it done. But basically, the five issues took me most of a year to get those done. And by the time I was in the last issues four and five, we had cast members left over from storylines that Jerry had started that, you know, Marty and I weren't doing. They were just kind of floating around the book because we hadn't gotten rid of them, and there was no good way in the story to dump these guys. So I was drawing a lot of characters. Didn't have a lot to do with the storylines. I was getting tired. So I gave up after about five issues, after almost a year's worth of work. Joe Staton took it over. I drew a few more covers. And right in that period, right then, is when Jeanette Kahn became the publisher of DC Comics and kind of revitalized some stuff and changed some things, and some stuff went a different direction. But I did five issues. The book was very goofy. I did it in a very different style from my earlier work. I tried to be a little more cartoony, a little funnier. And I mean, even though I had three different writers in five issues, which was kind of a lot to adjust it, I had a lot of fun.
Now, after that, you still did a few more things for DC, but then in, what was that, 1977, you started doing some work for Marvel?
Yeah, I worked at DC first 4 or 5 years of my career, partly because I was getting paid better by DC. Generally, again, back in those days, mostly the way we viewed it, I don't know if it's really true or not, we viewed it was that Marvel was an artist's company, and DC was a writer's company. And what that meant was that mostly writers got paid more money by DC than they would get paid by Marvel, and mostly artists got paid more at Marvel. Part of the justification of that, if there was such, is that at Marvel, the work you were doing is mostly done Marvel style. Are you guys familiar with the Marvel style, what that means? Some would be. But for those of you who don't, what it means is, essentially, if I'm the artist and Wheezy's the writer, what that means is that Wheezy would write a plot for a story for a comic. She'd give me the plot. I would draw 22 pages or however many pages the story is going to be of the art based on her plot. I would then give her the artwork back, and she would write all the dialogue based on the artwork. This is the way Stan and Jack worked. It's the way Stan and Steve Ditko worked. It was what really a method that Marvel, that Stan and the guys that worked with him and for him really did in the early Marvel comics. It's a way I really prefer. It's a way that almost nobody does today. Today we're all very, it's very heavily writers' comics with a lot of guys standing around talking and fabulous conversations and people, big headshots and stuff like that. So basically, well, just my favorite kind of comics. But be that as it may, The Metal Man itself was, after that first script by Steve, we worked mostly Marvel style, and I really liked it. But somewhere in 76, 77, Marvel offered me a gig, and they offered me more bucks as an artist than DC. And I shifted and began doing the Rampaging Hulk for Marvel in about 77 or 76, 77, somewhere in there. Also, there was a time, not now, I'm sure, but there was a time when there was a certain je ne sais quoi, where older editors at DC, maybe I shouldn't be saying all this stuff, this could be evil, but none of these guys are around, it won't matter, but editors at DC, they saw themselves as producing real comics, whatever that means, but it means it wasn't like Marvel. Like whatever Marvel was doing, those weren't like really comics. Real comics were Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, The Flash, and so on. And what it meant was, a couple of times, and once in a younger editor, it was a friend of mine actually, and I was stunned when it happened, they sort of expected you to do work for them for less money because they were real comics. Now, I'm not like the most grasping guy in the world, but if I'm being offered a difference of maybe 25 bucks a page in an era when I'm not getting any royalties, over an entire job, that's a lot. That begins to figure out to be part of my rent. So I'm not saying I didn't do any work for DC, but I remember a young editor offered me to do some cover, and it was a good bit less than I got paid for Marvel covers, and I declined, and he was astounded that I wouldn't be willing to take less money so I could draw a DC character. I think those days are long gone at this point, but that was kind of how it was at the time. It was a very strange world. Really?
Yeah, okay. Wheezy, so you worked at Warner until about 1980, you said.
That's about right, yeah.
And then you went over to Marvel.
I did.
But you went over to Marvel as an editor first.
Yes, I did. They handed me all of the licensed books and the Chris Claremont books.
I didn't say that.
Yes, you did. Chris had a reputation for being difficult to work with for some reason. I was supposed to take over the X-Men after they finished up the Phoenix Saga. But there was a little confusion with the Phoenix Saga. And I ended up getting the final issue. What happened was that, Chris came into my office because he loved to show me stuff and he knew I was going to be taking over the books and he wanted to show me his pages. And he was very proud of them, of course. So he showed me the pages where the Phoenix goes Nova and she fries the planet, a planet full of people. And Chris said, yeah, John threw this in. So I wrote, and all of the broccoli people screamed in agony as they fried. Okay. And I said, Chris, you can't do that. That makes Phoenix a supervillain. She's destroyed a whole planet full of people. Shooter isn't going to like it. He's not going to let you do that. And he said, oh, but Jim Salicrup, who was the editor, okay, that was Shooter, and Shooter read it, and he said it was fine. I said, okay, well, you know, I haven't been here that long. What do I know? So, da-da-da-da-da. Okay, Shooter sees it in print, and he goes ballistic. He says, I never saw this. I never okayed this. He pulled the book away from Salicrup, and he gave the last issue to me. So I guess Salicrup sort of edited the first half, and I got stuck with the entire second half, where we had to decide whether Phoenix was going to, let's see, Shooter, the choice that Shooter gave us was she could go to hell and be in torture forever, or she could die.
Wasn't there also one where she could have been like lobotomized or something?
Oh, I think Chris was going to lobotomize her. That was the idea. Okay. Was that she was going to be or have her talent, her brain blown out, since she was like the intelligence of a 5-year-old. Now I don't know, that maybe being dead is worse than that. So I said, okay, Chris, this is your choice. You know, this is what we're going to have to do. Whatever, death of Phoenix, or you know, she's stuck in agony forever. What do you want to do? And Chris said, all right, we'll kill her. Which was actually one of the better business decisions ever made in comics. But it was because Chris loved her.
I know.
Chris loved her so much that he couldn't stand for her to be tortured. So it was a good business decision made for a character reason, which is, you know, kind of backwards for a lot of things to happen now. And that was my first experience with the X-Men, was overseeing the new ending of the X-Men. This story's been, you know, in a lot of books all over the place, so you know, I'm sure you guys probably knew that one already.
That's what X-Men 137, is that right? Mm-hmm. Is that the Death of Phoenix issue? It's a double issue. If you go back and look at the credits, it's a double edited issue by Jim Salicrup and Louise Jones.
Yep.
And it put the X-Men into the stratosphere.
It did. After that, we were working on a story. We, of course, did a batch of stories after it, where it was rumored, got out there in the, you know, what passed for the fan press then, that we were going to do an issue where a lot of characters were going to be killed. It was the Days of Future Past story. And apparently the storyteller kept calling us up saying, So which issue is it where everybody dies? Because we want to order lots of that, having learned from what happened with the Phoenix stuff. And so we put on the cover, this issue, everybody dies. And so lots of that one, too. It was funny. It was funny the way the audience responded to their favorite characters being blown away quite eagerly, actually.
And it was a time when you didn't have the web, you didn't have all the press, the advanced press on stuff. Now it'd be very difficult to do an issue where you would surprise people about stuff because there's so much advanced PR on stuff and so many rumors and so on. It's a very different market. It'd be very hard. I mean, I can't imagine. I don't know what the reading experience for comics would be like now to not be professional, because there's so much information out there. I think it would be very different. If you were interested, you could find out so much stuff. It'd be very different to read comics on a month-to-month basis than it was 30 years ago.
And also, everything's scanned now right away, so it's so easy for someone to make a scan to send it to a colorist, but then you can make a little JPEG and you send it to a friend. I've gotten a few of those over the years. But, you know, most of the time you hope that people don't pass things on, that they keep to their conscience and don't blab things out, but you know, people do.
And actually, you can understand why stores would want to know in advance, because they, when an issue looks like it's something people are going to be really interested in, they want to order enough of them so they'll have them to sell. So, you know, it's a balancing act like everything else in the world. And I think maybe, just for my case, maybe it's gone a little bit, you know, you guys are getting too much information. But, you know, I think the store owners maybe need it, so whatever.
You also, in the digital world, you do learn fairly rapidly if you think about it at all. You never put anything anywhere digitally you don't want out there. You don't do anything weird in your art. You don't do anything weird in the writing. Once it's a digital form, it will never go away entirely. And so you just make sure that whatever you do, it's like being on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, don't put on Facebook. I saw someone did this. They put on Facebook, oh yeah, I faked an ID and my boyfriend and I went to a concert. We photoshopped an ID and went in.
Right.
Now, I'm not sure the guys are at the concert are ever going to get back these people, but I'm thinking, it's like a public forum. You're going to look for a job 5 years down. They're like, you know, they're in their early 20s or whatever they are. You're looking for a job. I know employers now where you routinely, somebody who's going to be hired, you Google them. You look at their pages. You look at whatever information's out there about them. You start finding stuff like, oh, yeah, I forged an ID and got in to see this thing. Well, it may not be much of a matter moment, and you're 20 years old, and you figure you can be discounted. But on the other hand, once you put that stuff out there, it never goes away.
Yeah, like if you put, yeah, I came home from my crappy job, and I stole a ream of paper.
And people do.
And you know, I mean, 10 years later, you're going for a better job, people see it. But anyway, we're getting off topic.
Yeah, yep. We are. That's totally off topic, yes.
So,
just be careful of your art and your writing.
Oh, and even though people did give me Chris Claremont's books because maybe they thought he was difficult to work with, I thought he was fabulous. I had a wonderful experience working with Chris. He's one of my best friends. And I thought he was a complete pleasure and a total font of ideas. So, there. Anyway.
And it was also very useful and easy to learn rapidly. It was not just true of Chris. If you're working with the freelancers and you would like to make sure that they're receptive to possible changes, which many freelancers are not, you feed them first. And if you feed them first, almost always they'll be far more receptive to your ideas. I'm just saying.
Anyway, so Walter, in the late 70s, you worked again with one of your favorite collaborators, Archie Goodwin, on the Alien adaptation, which, as I mentioned before, was really the first comic to ever, or graphic novel to ever become a bestseller on the New York Times list. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That was really was one of my best experiences in comics. At the time we were doing, of course, nobody had an idea Alien was going to become a property that would have legs that would last forever. But basically, Heavy Metal got the rights to do an Alien adaptation. John Workman was the art director at Heavy Metal. They did a lot of publication, mostly of European work. John was the guy, not only art director, he re-lettered everything from French to English or Spanish to English, whatever it was. So his idea initially was to ask Carmen Infantino to pencil the book and have me ink it. And he tried to get a hold of Carmine and couldn't reach him. So he called me up, and I knew John Cash, like kind of out of the blue, explained what the deal was. And I said, well, it sounds like kind of fun. Maybe I wouldn't mind doing that, doing the pencils and inks. And I suggested Archie as a possible writer. I wasn't writing at that point myself. So I didn't really think about becoming a writer and that stuff. I just thought, Archie would be great. So John called Archie. He was game to do it. In the end, the thing about that was amazing, I look back now, I can't imagine this, is that we were given three, and any kind of movie adaptation now, we were given three different script revisions went over about a 4 or 5 month period. They had scenes that were in, scenes that were out. They had scenes that did not appear in the movie. We were given all that stuff. Eventually, this was in the fall of 78, 20th Century Fox, who made the film, flew me and two other guys and one of their representatives over to London to go see a rough cut of the film. I had never been in London. I'd never been to Europe at all. So it was, I happened to have a valid passport at exactly the right time. So I was able to go, and like I had a 2-day notice. You'll be leaving Wednesday morning for London. I got flown to London. We were in Shepperton Studios. What are the two big studios? Shepperton and Pinewood. One of them, they were filming in one of them, and the other one had a better screening room. So they drove us to one, and we saw a 2.5-hour version of Alien. that included a scene where Harry Dean Stanton got killed that you did not see in the final print of that movie. It was just ghastly. It was great. It was really cool. But it was just ghastly. And that scene in the comic that I drew takes something from that version of the scene that I had seen, not the way it turned out in the movie exactly. It was much faster in the movie. But then they took us back to the other studio, and then we walked through the model shop. We got to see the stuff there. We saw three different Nostromos. One was a ton and a half that they did big shots for. One was the undocking scene. One was a smaller one that was used when they blew the alien away at the end of the film. We got to see everything. The special effects guy showed us the flamethrowers, which turned out to be the first flamethrowers anybody ever built, apparently, that were totally self-contained. In other words, no fuel packs on your back. Don't have to hook them up. Fuel self right there in little cylinders. You pick them up, you roll around, you pull a trigger, and you blew flame. They took the actors out of the meadows and had a practice. They were like real flame. That was not special effects. They were like real flamethrowers. They made the guy really nervous because he was really afraid they might be stolen. So every night, he would disassemble all the trigger mechanisms and take all the parts home with him at night and bring them back the next day and put them all back together again so nobody could take the flamethrowers and do anything awful with them. So, but we just had access. I can't imagine now doing a comic book and having that kind of access. I got to watch them film a scene. They'd done all the principal photography of the actors. They were still doing the model shots. So the rough cut we saw was full of all the acting. But then they would have scene missing when they were doing undocking or whatever. You knew what was going on, but they didn't show that stuff. And we got to watch them filming a scene with the alien. The actor who played the alien had already gone back to Africa, but they had another guy in the suit. So he was standing, and they were putting jelly on his mouth and filming a loop so it would drip down, which is how I discovered that the jelly in the alien's mouth was KY jelly, which was kind of funny. But it looked great. It looked perfectly fine. So we met Ridley Scott, got toured around by one of the producers. And in the end, when we went home, nobody said boo about the adaptation. There were no likeness rights. We didn't have to run approvals by anybody for that stuff. And Archie and I were left alone to produce what we thought was the best version of the story that we could produce given the information that we had. So we included at least two scenes in the comic, one of which was filmed, and I saw it in the rough cut, didn't make it into the final print, one of which I don't think at least was not in the rough cut that we saw. So, but we had a chance to produce what we thought was the best possible comic book out of that material. And I thought it actually worked out really well. I thought we did a nice job with it. I can't imagine now being given that kind of a freedom on any kind of property, really, where the comic book would be allowed to develop in its own way and come out as well as it did. So it was great. It was a phenomenal experience for me.
Can you talk about the coloring book?
On that, John, because it was a graphic novel for heavy metal, it was going to be printed in color, in full color, rather than the kind of flat color that they had in ordinary newsprint comic books. There was a process called blue line color. Anybody here know what that is? It's a long time ago. I see like four hands. Okay. Basically, it was a European, mostly in Europe, they would take the black and white artwork, they would basically photographically transfer it to drawing paper, but they would transfer the lines in kind of a blue, a very light blue that wouldn't reproduce, and they'd transfer the art onto a piece of acetate. So you had a piece of acetate with black lines on it. Then on the paper, you could color whatever you wanted. You could use oil paints or watercolors or whatever you wanted, and they would shoot the color from your full color original, but they would shoot the black from the acetate. What that meant was that the lines you drew were sharp and crisp. If you had drawn this in black on the paper and then painted the paper with a black line on it, the black line would get broken apart by the photographic process and wouldn't be sharp in the same way. We couldn't do that in America at the time, but I understood the process. So I had photostats made of all the artwork, all the black and white art. We rubber cemented it down to cardboard to keep it stiff, and then we watercolored the entire thing. I did the first 8 pages, and then it became very clear to me I could not do a 64-page comic writing and drawing and getting the color done in the time we had. We only had about 3 months to get the entire book done. So Wheezy and two of our other friends who were artists, became a colorist, and they did most of the coloring on the book, on watercolor, on these photostats. It worked out, in the end, it worked out pretty well.
Wheezy, after your introduction to the X-Men, I'm curious what your next projects were for Marvel as an editor, and then when you started writing.
Oh, gee, who can remember? I did the Conan books.
Savage Sword.
Savage Sword, and which was a black and white magazine. Then the Conan, King Conan, Star Wars, Battlestar Galactica. What else?
New Mutants.
That's right. Of course, we started New Mutants. I forgot about that most important thing. At that point, graphic novels began over on Epic. Chris and I were, the first issue of New Mutants was supposed to be just a regular comic book, but it turns out that there was an artist whose name we won't necessarily mention, this one, who didn't turn in his Star Slavers graphic novel, because it left a hole in the schedule. So Shooter told me, well, all right, this New Mutants first double-sized first issue is now a graphic novel, and it's due a month sooner than it would have been due before.
Wait a second. The proportions would have been wrong, wouldn't they?
They were wrong. Look at it.
Okay.
Yep. It didn't matter.
Yeah, and what's your point?
We had a pretty slot to fill it. By golly, we were going to fill it. The proportions are wonky on that one. So Bob McLeod was inking that book.
And he wanted to ink it.
He wanted to ink it also. That's what happened. Thanks.
No problem.
And he was getting married and going on his honeymoon during this month when he would have to be desperately working on the book to turn it in to meet Shooter's brand new surprise deadline. And I had told him that he would be able to do the book completely himself before Shooter did this to us on the deadline. So Shooter came down to me and he said, well, he's just going to have to get thrown off. I said, no, we'll get it done. I lied, because it wasn't fair to pull him off right in the middle. And it wasn't fair to the book to pull the artist off right in the middle of the book. So we missed that deadline. So that deadline was missed twice. And I was on Shooter's bad list for probably a year after that, which I deserved, and had no resentment at all about being on it, because I had placed myself there squarely and fairly. But I didn't want to have lied to Bob. That wouldn't have been fair either.
Good for you.
Yeah, there you go. You see, Scott and I are the same kind of editors, and we ended up in the same kind of trouble all the time, right? Yep. The end. So I guess that was that.
But Bob got to do it.
Bob got it done, and we got it, and it came out. It was pretty.
It was nice.
So I don't know, what else did I work on? Who can remember?
That's a lot of the stuff you did.
That was a lot of the stuff I did.
And Savage Sword was like 60 pages a month.
That's
or whatever.
Right. Savage Sword was long. So at that point, I was doing, I think over one summer, I had put out, I think, 11 books in a month. That was a lot. And Shooter began to realize that the output was more than a lot of the editors could handle. I actually didn't have a problem handling it, because I hired people whose work I really admired, and editors and writers who were good writers, and letterers who were good letterers and didn't make a lot of mistakes. And so I could actually do 11 books a month.
It's funny how that works out.
Yeah, isn't it? You know, you hire good people, and guess what happens? You get good product. So Shooter hired, and everybody's workload was suddenly cut in half. And it was like,
Shooter hired new editors.
He hired new editors, right. And everybody's workload was cut in half, and I was bored. The Shooter had been after everyone to freelance for a while as well. And I had been reluctant to do that, because I was an editor and had an editor's salary. And it just didn't seem fair to take work away from a writer who was depending on that work to feed his family. But I thought, well, maybe if I made something up, if I created it brand new, well, I wasn't taking work away from anybody. In fact, I was providing work for a writer. I mean, an artist, Jay Mead. So I told Shooter, well, I had this weird idea for four little kids who were superheroes. And Shooter said, Well, it sounds kind of strange, but maybe we can get a miniseries out of it. You know, write up a proposal. So I did a first plot and character descriptions. A really fine young artist named Jude Brinkman came through my office looking for work. Yay, yay, Jude. And I didn't have any place for her in my regular lineup of books, but it turned out she could draw kids. So I said, well, look. And I gave her my notes, plot, and the character descriptions. I said, draw them. And if I like what you do, then I'll present us as a team. And, you know, we'll do power pack. So she came in with these fabulous little drawings. You know, Jack was this kind of cranky little kid who, I mean, he's the bad boy of the group. And he had his arms all folded and his lips all stuck out, pouting like that. And Julie, I don't know, the kids were perfect. June had just taken their personalities and visually pushed them just a little farther. And I loved it. So I turned the thing into Shooter, the plot and the descriptions and June's art. And I said, okay, this is Power Pack. This is what we want to do. And we thought maybe we'd get a miniseries. And Shooter said, this is fabulous. This is the best plot synopsis I've ever read. I've read Hollywood screenplays that were not this well produced or something like that. Whatever, Shooter liked her hyperbole at that point. And he said, all right, you've got yourself a series. And the first issue is due in, whenever, 2 months, three months. And June and I were looking at each other going, oh my God. June had never drawn a comic book before in her life. I had never written a comic book before in my life. And suddenly we have a series. So, but we did it. We got it done. And it was popular. People liked it. So it continued for a while.
Very well. Good. Good job, baby.
Wasn't June's background that she did caricatures at a...
Yes. She did. She worked at a Six Flags. Doing, you know, one of these artists who's just sit around doing drawings at Six Flags. You know, you go up that and you want a portrait, and they'll do one of you. So that's how Jude got her practice drawing kids.
The thing is,
it turned out that she did tell me later that she kind of exaggerated her experience drawing kids, which let that be a lesson to all of you. It's okay to exaggerate, but then you had better be able to pull it off, which Jude did beautifully. So
the thing about that simply is that at that time, particularly, there were a lot of artists in comics who really did not draw children very well. I mean, most of you were not called upon to draw children. Kids had different proportions from adults. The face is differently proportioned. And if you don't get it right, what you get is you get like little miniature adults running around pretending to be children. And June was actually able to draw, not only draw children, but draw children with great personality. And that made all the difference in that book.
Yeah, it was a really pretty book.
It was.
Now I'm actually going to ask Walter one more question, and after that
I was going to take some questions.
Yeah, we'll go to Q&A.
Oops.
You know,
hey, really?
Sick of my questions by now. One thing I want to say though before, have any of you seen Walter Simonson's The Mighty Thor Artist Edition? Well, I just happen to have.
But can't pick up. Oh, there you go.
Copy of it here. And for those of you who don't know what it is, it collects seven issues of Walter's Thor run, all shot from the original art, all scanned in color. So while it appears to be in black and white, it actually is in color, because you can see color of the paper, the whiteout, any blue lines, anything that's on the original pretty much is here. At the end of this, we'll be giving out one of these to somebody in the audience. Although I haven't figured out how we're going to do that yet.
How is this actually going to work? I want to know that answer.
I just figured Walter was going to pick
up a game of scissors, stone, paper.
Oh.
There we go. Okay. Now we're going to do musical chairs.
That would be awesome.
I am kind of tempted to do that now. We can do an extra 10 or 15 minutes, then we'll do it. Anyway, the last question I had, Walter, I'll turn it over to the audience. You had mentioned earlier that with Alien that you hadn't thought about writing. And so you thought about Archie. Now, that was about 1978?
Mm-hmm, that's right, 1978.
I think one of the first things I remember reading by you, maybe I'm wrong, was an issue of Battlestar Galactica. And it was called something like, you know, Cylon Mark III, There Is None Better, I think.
That, it was a Cylon Mark II. I didn't rewrite that one. That was more, right before I began writing. But it was when I inked. It was the only issue of the Galactica series that I inked.
But then you penciled
inked. I penciled and inked. Mostly Klaus Janson did the inks. I did the pencils.
And that's a phenomenal issue, by the way. That is really a great story, great art, really good stuff.
If you've ever seen the original Battlestar Galactica, now we watched him. I was a little too old for it, but I watched it. I was doing the comic book. The Cylons are kind of like cannon fodder. Because of these big robots are like 6 feet higher, taller. Apparently, they were costumes worn by stuntmen. The requirement was you had to be at least 6 feet tall or higher to be able to wear the costume to be a Cylon. And if you ever watch the show, Cylons die by the thousands, and people just always seem to be able to dodge laser beams. I don't know how that works exactly, but that's the way it worked. And so Roger McKenzie, who was the writer in that book, and I were thinking about this, and we thought, You know, Cylons, let's say they have artificial intelligence or whatever they've got, and they've got those base stars with the overlords. I forget what those guys were called, but whatever their overlords were called. And wouldn't you think that after a while somebody would say, well, you know, we're manufacturing millions of Cylons, and all that happens to them is they get killed. Maybe we should improve them. Maybe we should make a Mark II. So we did a story in which we invented a Mark II Cylon. And I designed them from the ground up, basically. And we had a storyline in this one issue. And we made a Mark II Cylon. If you ever go back and look at the issue, it's actually Baron von Richthofen, who was the supreme leading ace of World War I, a German fighter pilot who was known for flying a red triplane. And it's probably better known now for being in Peanuts than anywhere else. But basically was a real guy. If you look at the Mark II Cylon, he's essentially a World War I flying ace. He has goggles, a flying helmet, a scarf, jodhpurs, and boots. Except in kind of a robot-y way. And the plane he's flying, it's not a triplane, it's a single-wing spacecraft, but it's all red with white trim, which is kind of what Richthofen's plane was. So we used that. I just did that for fun. But we did the story. What happened was, at the end of that story, literally, Roger got off Galactica, and I ended up writing like scripting the last two pages or something like that at the very end of that story to wrap it up. And then I think there might have been a fill-in at that point for one issue. I don't know what the numbering now, but essentially there was something else. Maybe one of those weird things that we did, some fill-ins that were there. And then at that point, 78, 79, through nepotism, my girlfriend happened to be the editor on the book. She had been pushing me to do some writing. And so she said, well, you know, we're out of a writer on Galactica. Why don't you write some Galactica? And I thought, well, I like nepotism. I think that could work great for me. So I tried my hand. I guess issue number 19 is The Daring Return of the Space Cowboy. It was a Starbucks story.
Yeah.
And I wrote it and drew it. Klaus inked it. And I did, out of the last five issues of Galactica, I wrote four out of the five. The book was dying. It wasn't doing very well, but it sort of gave me a chance to, again, kind of practice my craft in a place where nobody was paying attention. So I could make whatever mistakes I had made, nobody saw much. Archie Goodwin, who by that time was over at Marvel, liked those issues a great deal. He was about to embark on writing an adaptation of a movie coming up, Archie was always terminally late on lots of stuff. And so he stopped me in the hall one day and said, you know, I really like what you did in Galactica. Would you like to write this movie adaptation for this movie coming up? John Buscema is going to pencil it. I was in right then. John's penciling it. Klaus is inking it. It's something called Raiders of the Lost Ark. I have no idea. Okay, well, I said, well, you know, I'm sure. So it turned out to be a three-issue comic. I wrote the adaptation. I had the screenplay. I had John Buscema. I had Klaus Janson. It was Duck Soup. It was great. And then after that, I began doing more writing and began writing most of my own work at that point. So it came out pretty well.
All right, let's take some questions from the audience. Gentlemen over here.
First of all, I think I speak for everyone. I want to say thank you for the memories.
You're quite welcome.
My five-year-old son sees four hit something, he feels it. And I did too. And I don't see it a lot now. And I just wanted some information on how we came to be able to show that and give it that feeling.
Well, I don't have a real clear answer for you, but the comics. I'm a huge Jack Kirby fan, and one of the things you should all clap. One of the things that I like best about Jack's work, but by no means the only thing, is that he really invested his characters with life and energy and power. And so, what I tried to do in a lot of my work, especially early on where I was looking at a lot of Jack's stuff, I don't have to look, I've brought so much of it into my own brain, I don't have to. I didn't try to be Jack, I didn't want to. Jack's drawing is very specific, it's very clear. I do some things like when a guy throws a punch, his legs are 14 feet apart, that kind of thing. But basically, I tried to find some way to bring that kind of power into the figure work, into the action within the panel. Part of that's a matter of drawing, the figure drawing. Part of it's a matter of design, of creating shapes within a panel that make sense, that actually complement each other and reinforce each other. Part of it's doing that across an entire page. When you draw a page of comics, it's almost like creating a collage. There are a lot of ways to look at it. But you not only are composing a panel and whatever's happening in the panel, and telling the story of what's in that panel, you're also composing your entire page. I remember being told as a kid, I'm not a painter, I'm terrible at painting, but I remember painting constructors saying, well, you know, when you're painting, you need to have you lead the eye into the painting, and you have a center of interest, and you have a way of getting out. I don't have any idea if any painter ever thinks about that stuff. I don't know. But in comics, you kind of have that because it's built in, because you have panels that read across, and you go in up here, and you come out down below. So I'm not only composing an individual panel, I'm trying to figure out some design work so that every panel relates to the entire page. The entire page itself has some sense of structure that gives a stability to it. But you can also do things that are asymmetrical that will give energy. And all that stuff, there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. I mean, I also thought about pages as architecture for a time, where the bottom of the page is going to have a kind of a base that the rest of the page can sit on. Again, there are a lot of ways to look at it, but I thought a lot about page design and panel design and leading the eye through a page in a way that will essentially reinforce not only the story, but do it in an energetic way. I don't know if that, I mean, it's not, you probably won't be able to go home and draw because of that, what I just said, but that's kind of, it's a matter of how you think about the work in a sense, and that's what I'm trying to capture in the work that I do. Hope that was clear.
Walt, you've written and talked often about how you worked your college thesis about the story of Gordie Dunn College into your epoch-making run in the 80s on Thor. You did initial run on Thor in the 70s doing layouts. Did you have any urge at that time to start redesigning things and turning it into what you eventually redesigned Asgard and Thor into?
You know, I didn't really. I mean, my view of the 70s, and there are some exceptions to this, Shang-Chi and Paul DeLacy's work, other guy, Doug Bench, other guys are an example. But at the time, in a way, I'll speak just for me. I think others true of other guys, but I'll speak just for me. I was essentially trying to capture what I saw in the 60s in the comics I was doing for Marvel in the 70s. Part of it was that we'd all seen Jack Kirby create a lot of stuff for Marvel, or co-create a lot of stuff for Marvel in the 60s. And then by the end of the 60s, early 70s, we're like, well, Jack, thanks a lot. See you around. Thanks for helping us out with all this stuff and grounding Marvel Universe ground up. And goodbye. For which Jack, you know, he got very little out of having done an astounding amount of creation work. So I was not so eager to create new characters. There were a lot of guys, I think, but I'll just speak for me, where you took the existing pieces. It's like one of those things like in, I don't know, they really have them in casinos, but like poker chips, you have like a giant birdcage, like an hourglass with chips in it, and you do it like that, and all the chips fall down to the bottom, and they change, so it's a way of mixing things up. And I kind of feel that's the way the stories were done. We took a lot of existing elements and tried to make them into new patterns, but it wasn't like we added a lot of new elements exactly. And that was also my time, that year on Thor. Len Wein wrote it. The first year I did it. Len Wein wrote it. I was doing the layouts. Tony DeZuniga, for the most part, was inking it and doing finishes. And I was trying to capture you know, what I had liked about the Jack Kirby Stan Lee Thor. So I did not, you know, I was trying to draw Asgard with ramps and towers and great sculptures and whatever, that kind of thing. I did not sit back and say, let me rethink this stuff. Partly because I did that for a year in 77, 78, whenever it was. When I was given the book to write about 5 years later, I think, I didn't think about it consciously, but I think that I had done my Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Thor for a year, and it gave me perhaps a certain freedom to rethink what I was doing. I still tried to capture the essence of what I thought made that work great, but it maybe gave me more freedom to go in new directions that I would not have gone 5 or 6 years earlier. I may also have been slightly more mature as an artist, but I wouldn't be pushing that as an idea. Can't be sure. Yes, sir.
Yes, my question for both of you is, how was it like working with Jeanette Kahn while she was running DC Comics?
That was great.
Yeah, it was fine.
what specifically, what do you mean?
Yeah, like, you know, the style of the stories, you know, that you could, did you feel like you could do more, you know, liberated work when she took over as a
You know, honestly, I probably went over to Marvel not long after Jeanette became publisher. My only, and I didn't, and even the stuff I did for DC, I didn't work with Jeanette herself. The only thing I can say about that is I was doing the Metal Men still, doing covers for the Metal Men when she came in as publisher. And I did one cover that was actually for a reprint of the old Metal Men in this run they were doing. They needed to fill in to get caught up on some deadlines. And when the cover came back, it had, I think, an ink note at the bottom of it. We just said, great cover, JK. Hey, okay. So I was just fine. So that was as close as I think I got to working. We got to know Jeanette later, but that was probably as close as I got to working with her in that sense. But she was very encouraging and I think fairly open-minded to a lot of different stuff.
Yeah, when she first came in as publisher, I was still at Warren. And she did call me a couple of times and try to get me to come edit at DC. At the time, but I wasn't ready to leave Warren yet, so I turned her down. And then I was over at Marvel. She was publisher a long time. Because I went over to Marvel and worked there for 10 years. And then I went to DC and she was still publisher. So and she was great. I mean, she had her own agendas and things that she needed to accomplish while she was there, involving television and licensing and all of that. So those did put some constraints on what we could and couldn't do. But, mostly it was understandable. And she was really pretty nice to work with. She was a character.
She was.
And she's doing really well now in movies. So yay Jeanette.
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't that a fabulous movie?
Fantastic. Good for her.
She's great.
Very pleased about that, about her success. Yes, ma'am.
So, well, first of all, I want to say how much I love Bay Area Bill.
Oh, thank you very much.
So, Louise, I loved your run on New Mutants, like, so much.
Cool.
And I wanted to know, how did you feel like when they recently, when they brought back Doug Ramsey?
You know, the only reason I was aware of it was because people got on the internet and asked me that question. And I say, good for them. There was no reason why for Doug to have stayed dead as long as he did. Except for, I remember Bob Harris hated Doug Ramsey. I mean, honestly.
So he won't be coming back at DC anytime soon.
No. Poor Doug, poor old Doug. We killed him. But obviously, I mean, he had the transplant virus. That was very clear from one of Chris's panels earlier. So I just couldn't believe that anyone would leave him dead. I mean, we killed him because the readers hated him. And the artists hated him. And he wasn't so easy to write either. Poor Doug. Not fair. It was his power, I don't know if you guys know, his power was to be able to translate languages, which meant if you were going to actually put Doug in a story and use his power, then you had to throw in a language that worked into the story for him to translate every single issue.
Oh, look, there's a secret cryptogram behind the door. Doug, would you come over here for a minute, please? And every issue.
Not a very visual power. I mean, when he bonded with Warlock and they kind of became a bonded being, that was sort of cool. But, comic books, things change, and characters die, but you don't honestly expect them to stay dead, because guess what? It's comic books. So, and Doug, obviously, I mean, I never kill a character unless I know how I'll bring it back. I just couldn't believe that he stayed dead as long as he did.
And I will say, this is just for me, that the issue after he died, when Warlock went and dug him up and tried to carry him around, I think that comic is one of the nicest short meditations on death and its meaning I've seen. I know my wife wrote it, I don't care, that I've seen really in a comic. Comics have a short form. If you haven't read it, it's a wonderful short meditation on death and what it means. And I'm delighted.
And honestly, I have to say, I got some really weird mail on that one. Are you doing? I mean, what happens is that Warlock takes down, but this, okay, in with Warlock's culture, he's this robot-y kind of creature. And he was able, the characters could exchange energy, and if they could give each other energy, they wouldn't die. So he takes Doug around, and he shows him everything, saying, well, take my energy, and of course, it doesn't work. So
he digs Doug's body up and carries his body around.
He pours it out of a coffin.
But he does, yes. But he kind of hauls it around, trying to persuade him to come back to life again, because that's how it should be.
And everybody expected Doug to come back eventually. I mean, obviously he should. Bob Harris got very fed up with this. This is after I left. And insisted that there be a panel that showed Doug's skeleton underground in his coffin. Somebody faces, maybe Kitty, I don't remember, faces through, and oh, whoops, there's a skeleton. He's got to be dead, but guess what? He came back.
It's like, come on, it's comics. Anybody can get better. I don't care what, I don't care how badly you're dead, you can always get better.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, I always go out. I never kill a character unless I know how to bring them back. So that's it. Anyway, is that okay?
Okay. Actually, just one second.
Yes.
This is going to be the last question. Sorry for the guys back there, but just hold on for one quick
second. We're running out of time. I'm really sorry.
Sorry.
Good luck with that. All right. Well, you guide me.
You're the one who's going out and giving it out.
Well, I'll hand it, but we're almost done. All right.
All right. Last
question.
Actually, while we have this last question, I'd like to ask everyone, while we're going to give out the book, could everybody move up and fill in all the seats as much as you can?
Anybody? If you want one of the books, if you don't want the book, it's okay. But if you like the book, we just want to fill in all the seats because we have to choose through the seats. And if we choose a blank seat, I get to keep the book. So, oh, I like that idea. Don't come up.
Yeah, we're just trying to make it the fairest way possible.
Thank you very much.
All right, go ahead with your question.
Okay. Well, I read Alien when I was 9 and didn't sleep for 3 days, so thanks
solid.
To me and my parents.
Hey, my work is done here.
And my question is for both of you, but specifically for you, Louise, with your background in editing, there's a stereotype that I've been hearing all around the continent, different panels, about how current writers and artists are prima donnas and don't get things in on time, and that older artists back in the day, there was a level of craftsmanship and professionalism that just isn't around anymore. I'm wondering, how do you feel about current talent and the professionalism that you guys, that both of you work with?
Well, I personally figured that this rumor has probably been spread by people of our generation who
aren't getting enough work.
Because those young, talented guys who probably are turning in all their work on time are either, who knows? I haven't heard that, so I don't know. Seem to be.
Honestly, the guy probably should be asking is Scott.
Yeah,
he probably
really
works with more young talent than
Scott,
we do.
What do you think?
So, I mean, it's certainly true that I think one of the skeins in human history and human storytelling is that, in lots of places, is that the old days were better.
Oh, yes.
And the new days suck. Now, there's a lot of ways to phrase that, but
everybody has their own golden age. You know, I mean, your golden age was Jack Kirby. You know, Wheezy, I'm not sure what your golden age was.
Robert Heinlein, maybe.
That's great. You know, my golden age was, you know, actually, my golden age was, you know, from Neil Adams to Mike Kaluta to Walter to, you know, about a dozen other guys in the early 70s when I was Joe Kubert, Jack Kirby, Commandy. But anyway.
All right, so what do I do first?
Okay, so there we go.
Pick A and B?
That wasn't a great answer, I realized.
Hang on a minute.
Sorry.
Okay, A.
of these numbers randomly.
Okay. There. So, yeah, six. Oh. Yeah, five. That's close enough.
And then over here.
First room. And somewhere there.
Very scientific. Okay. All right. So I am going to send Walter out among you.
Oh, goodness, great. Oh, great. So they'll kill me. When, don't kill the messenger. That's all I can tell you.
I want to set a ground rule, though. If it turns out, first, you know, please stay in your seats. Don't try to move over anything. If it turns out that there isn't someone in that particular seat, the person, it's at Walter's discretion only who he decides to give it to. In the.
Oh, thanks.
There you go.
All right.
All right. Now, the way we're doing it is that side A... That's side B, and then we go back as far as row 20.
You better direct me then.
Okay,
so.
We're going to go with A. Walter picked these, by the way, on this side. Row 6. And seat 11, starting down there.
I'm going to make seat 11.
That's person 11, not me. Well, then the last person, don't you think?
The last person in this row.
Yeah. Thank you. Oh, and actually, it comes with a box, too, to protect it. So if you want the box, come on up. The box is $100, though. All right, I got a laugh, finally.
I think we're all set.
Yeah. Thank you very, very much.
All right, folks, thanks very much.